This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Some scholars are criticized for staying within the so-called ivory tower and creating work that's only accessible to a highly academic audience. My guest today rarely hears that criticism. In fact, she calls herself a community accountable scholar, which means she makes it her mission to bring scholarly ideas into non-academic settings. This manifests in an online education project, where she creates accessible curricula from Black feminist work, but also brings the approach to her own writing. She recently co-edited an anthology called Revolutionary Mothering, Love on the Front Lines. It highlights many stories of marginalized mothers of color. She's also completed a forthcoming book of poetry called Spill, Scenes of Black Feminist Fugitivity, I should say. Alexis Pauline Gumbs will be giving a TEDx talk in Durham this weekend. She's going to talk about her work, but first she joins me in the studio. Alexis, welcome back. Good to have you here.
It's great to be here, Frank.
Tell us about this book now, the anthology, Revolutionary Mothering.
Yes. So Revolutionary Mothering is a project that, for me, I've been researching this idea of mothering, especially how mothers of color have thought about mothering in the United States, given that it's been a narrative of blame, right? Mothers of color, whether they be immigrants or poor mothers, Black mothers have been blamed for social issues for decades, basically my entire life. That's been the narrative. So I was interested in how it came up in literary work and activist work by feminists of color. At the same time, a close friend of mine, Maya Williams, was we were writing each other back and forth, right? So she was in Chiapas, she was in Palestine, she was in Egypt with revolutionary mothers and also having her first child, who's my cyber goddaughter. And we thought there has to be a place for this to come together. And for me as a community accountable scholar, it was the opportunity to not just continue my dissertation work by writing about mothers, but to really write with the mothers who I feel like have so much to say.
And you make a distinction between mothering and motherhood.
Absolutely. So motherhood is something we think we know what it is, right? And so it exists within a construct of patriarchy. Motherhood is something, it's a status, it's a role that people get, but really for what they produce and give back to an existing system. But what Hortense Spillers teaches us, a Black feminist theorist whose work I love more than I can even describe, she really makes the distinction that in American slavery, the work of mothering was exploited labor that didn't necessarily give enslaved people any status whatsoever. So the mothering labor that they did didn't mean that the people that they mothered couldn't be sold away from them. If they did mothering labor, which they were often forced to do on behalf of white children or their slave owners' families, it also didn't give them any status that could be legally upheld. And so we think about mothering because of the way that it's been used so flexibly. We say, well, we can actually use it in a queer way. We can actually say that if mothering is not necessarily specifically attached to one gender, mm-hmm. or attached to a specific legal status or even a biological or birthing role, then mothering is work that anybody can do. And Alice Walker says that mothering is something that we all need to learn how to do if our species is going to stay on the planet.
And what is that work?
That work is the work of keeping each other alive. That's the most simple way to say it, right? It looks many ways. It does look like feeding each other. It does look like healing work and healthcare. It does look like the activism that we see mothers taking leadership on to make sure that education is something that's collectively thought about. Health is something that's collectively thought about. What it means to think about other human beings existing for their own sake and saying the work of making that happen is work that we all need to do.
And inherent in this, then, is the assumption that for that those who you are mothering to be safe, secure, and have a future, it really means thinking about the safety and future of more than just the offspring, however you would define that offspring, that you are mothering, that it really means taking into account a far greater collective.
Absolutely. So when we think about revolutionary mothering, we're thinking of it not in the way that motherhood in the nuclear family sense would say, well, we only have to care about the education and well-being of this one person or these two people or these people who live in our household. We know that how mothering has looked has been different from that. People have taken care of each other across those lines in extended families, in communities, and this revolutionary mothering practice that we're talking about is something, it's not just something we're advocating for. This book is evidence that it's been happening, right? It's something that people are doing. They're creating collective ways of feeding each other, of thinking about what does it mean for our entire community to be educated or for our schools to be accountable for the children who are actually there. And this is work that people, women of color, have been doing most of this work. We also think that even though mothering is something that everyone can do, this book is an opportunity to learn from the people who've been doing that work over and over and over again.
So tell us about those people. You solicited contributions from a range of women. Tell us about them.
Absolutely. Well, some of the first inspiration for this were mothers of color who were blogging on the internet already. So people with blogs like Brown Femi Power, Fabulosa Mujer, Hermana Resist. These were blogs where people were talking about their revolutionary ideas, but also their process of clarifying and learning some of those revolutionary ideas through their work as mothers. And so those were some of the people that we reached out to. There's a beautiful photo essay in here by Noemi Martinez, who created Hermana Resist Press and also a zine and also a blog with the same name. Such a genius and a beloved sister comrade. And Fabiola was the person who created Fabulosa Mujer. And she has an incredible essay in here as well. That was really the core of the people that we first were thinking of when we wanted to create this book. Now, when we sent out the call, there were so many responses, and it was a blessing. It really has put us into network with people who identified with this and who wanted
to
share. So
then did you get, because the people you identified and just described sound like they have a kind of real academic or theoretical grounding, at least, and then brought their own personal experience to it. Once the network expanded, did you start hearing from people who may not be so attached to the academic world?
Actually, I think it may have been the other way around. So the people who were talking about this a lot online didn't necessarily have academic access. They were definitely involved in activism in their communities, but not necessarily in an academic way. And that's why they actually didn't wait for there to be a book, right, to do this writing. They were like, we're posting this online. We're doing this every day. We're doing it in between all the work that we do as mothers. When we actually put it out as a call for a book, and the initial title we had was This Bridge Called My Baby, a lot of people were reminded of the book This Bridge Called My Back, which is a major inspiration for us, an anthology of feminists of color that was published in 1981. And so a lot of the people who responded were people who had read that work, who saw themselves as participating in that discourse. So I would say that more of the scholar writers that we got was after the book call.
Well, we are joined now by one of the contributors to the anthology. Norma Maroon wrote an essay called Why Don't You Love Her? She just completed her postdoc in education at Duke and is now an assistant professor at UNLV, University of Las Vegas, Nevada. Norma, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
Your essay tells the story of having two mothers. Tell us about it.
Yes, I always grew up having two mothers, but it was always difficult to fit into this traditional definition of what it means to be in a family, right? Like this normative patriarchal family. I never really fit into that. And so it wasn't until I became really in higher education, when I became exposed to a lot of the Chicana feminist writing, like Cherry Moraga, Gloria Anzaldúa, that I realized I don't have to fit into this normative understanding of what it means to be a family. And so I wrote about how, you know, having two mothers was actually a family, and it was really about queering the family, or la familia, right? And so I write about how if it wasn't because my biological mother really defined family, if it wasn't for her redefining family, we wouldn't have survived in the U.S. because, again, you know, we needed to tap into different networks, different social other women who were there to nurture me.
Well, maybe you should tell us then about your two mothers.
Yeah, so I came to the U.S. when I was 7 years old with my biological mother, and then my mother was a caregiver for a family, but I couldn't live with her, and so I was raised by one of her best friends who later adopted me when I was 12, 13 years old, And so I would visit my biological mother. She lived down the street. But I was raised by another woman, so I always had these two mothers. And when my friends would come over, they're like, well, why do you have two mothers? And I said, well, it was always hard for me to explain. But so my adopted mother, we call her Tia, my aunt. And then my biological mother, my mom. But then later on, as an adult, I really embraced, no, I have two mothers. One doesn't have to be my Tia.
Can you read an excerpt for us from your essay?
Yeah. Amma, I'm not mad at you. If anything, I admire your strength and courage for choosing to leave Mexico. You came to this country in hopes of finding a way out of poverty and to give us a better life. But you soon realized that life was just as difficult in the U.S. Why do you always say that I don't love you? It hurts me when you tell me that I don't love you. You say that I love my adopted parents more than you. Please do not make me choose. It's not fair. Why is it that every time I try to talk to you about my adoption, you accuse me of being bitter and cold-hearted? I'm tired of you telling lies about me. Why do you tell my sister, my brother, your family, and your friends that I don't love you? It is painful when people ask me, why does your mother think that you don't love her?
Norma Maroon reading from her essay, Why Don't You Love Her?, part of a new anthology called Revolutionary Mothering, co-edited by my other guest today, Alexis Pauline Gumbs. Norma, what does the term revolutionary mothering mean to you?
Revolutionary mothering means being, again, stepping from that normative definition of what it means to be a family, what it means to be mothered. It means, as Alexa said, taking care of each other, being there for each other, and forgetting about those on the margin, about remembering to take care of those on the margin.
Coming through that confusion that you expressed earlier and some of the pain of it, how did you come to this other understanding?
Well, I think it was really difficult to deal with the pain because I never really talked about it growing up. And again, it was reading a lot of the feminist literature that I was able to say it's okay to feel the pain, it's okay to talk about the pain. And in me acknowledging that pain, it actually brought me closer to my mother, to my biological mother. It was in that making peace with it and acknowledging that part of the pain was moving forward and being closer to my mother.
Alexis, what does Norma's story highlight to you about the act of revolutionary mothering?
Norma's story is, and the generosity of sharing such a personal story also, really to me spoke to this connection to that earlier work, right? And so it's no surprise that Norma had been reading work like the work that Sheree Moraga and Gloria Anzaldúa put together in this bridge called My Back, because in that book you do see daughters speaking to their mothers. You see daughters thinking about what is it that these systemic violences and systems of oppression have done to us, and how can I talk about it from a very personal place and see this is what this has done to my life, to my heart, to my family. And so Norma does that. And I think that there are political implications for that. I think there are implications to how we think about everything, because when you look at the policies, like some of the policies we have right now in North Carolina, right, about immigration and how many families are separated by these policies, how many children are harmed and not only unmothered by being taken away from their biological mothers, but also harmed by laws that say they shouldn't have schools and streets in places where there are high rates of immigration. Norma's story is saying, like, who does this really hurt? And then where does the love come from, right? Like, who steps in order to heal this? And Norma's story really looks at the different layers of how gendered violence, immigration and also economic exploitation impact us, but not just as buzzwords and terms, but how do they really impact us on the personal level?
And just to be clear, what you're talking about when you say you shouldn't have schools or lights or infrastructure, this refers to the sanctuary bill that would punish mm-hmm. cities that actually would allow families to stay together. And so this is, and I think this is key to some of what you're doing, this idea of a bridge. The notion that personal pain and family struggle could be seen as your problem until you put it in this other context and realize that it is systemic and that it falls disproportionately on certain groups of people.
Absolutely, and especially children.
What about the idea of bridge, too? This is not only is it seeing these stories in context to understand that it's not a personal problem, but also the idea that women and women of color have been managing these in ingenious and often improvisational ways for generations.
Absolutely. So the quote unquote lack of infrastructure, or we could say understanding neoliberalism, really the divestment from infrastructure in particular communities and in a social safety net in general in the United States, the people who have had to then fill the gap and be the bridge and do the labor of making sure that people eat, making sure that people have alternative access to healing and health care, making sure that these educational ideas are brought in where they've been taken out of schools, have been predominantly women of color who have done the work of being the school and the food source and the source of home. And as Norma was saying, have had to find each other in order to do that together, right? One person can't do that by themselves. And so the networks that women of color have created are also an important model for what we would call, and what the Sisterhood of Single Black Mothers of Brooklyn would call, a motherful society, right? A society where that life-giving work is happening in abundance.
Norma, as you take a look at some of the other essays in this this volume, I wonder what impact that had on you.
One of the things that a common theme that I found was this nurturing of activism in the home. I think when a lot of the contributors didn't actually say like, oh yeah, my parents were teaching activism, they weren't using that academic language, but it was being nurtured in the home and how they kind of follow this pathway of activism and fighting for their families and their communities, whatever pathway they took. I thought that was really wonderful in that it wasn't just mothers, but it was fathers and community members and the elders. So again, this community of nurturing activism in children.
We've been talking about the volume, collection of essays, Revolutionary Mothering, but Alexis, you have a new volume of poetry coming out very soon. I only have about a minute or so left, but do you think you could read for us?
Sure. So this is the idea of this collection, Spill, Scenes of Black Feminist Fugitivity, is really that black feminist theory, people think that it's very complicated. It is complicated, but it's not any more complicated than what it is to just live as a black woman in this society. So this is from the perspective of a woman who does hair on her porch. Her fingerprints, rewritten rivers of coconut oil and shea, strands the geological memories, punctuating the groove, and hands God herself, who moves and moves and moves. Some would say she is slick. Some would say she is thick. Most would not say she is soaked in the universe. Most would not compare the tiny ridges on her fingertips to the oldest forms of script. Most would not connect the floorboards of her porch to the roots that they remember when she sits. Most would not observe her face, looking for patterns that are visible from space. Her clients keep their backs to her. They have no eyes for what she sees. And the sea? Well, they forget the ocean, themselves. But the desert, they remember, enough to long for moisture and to trust. Her eyelids know stream beds are pathways, know water from sky, know there is a spiritual reason why your scalp is dry. Nor no cornrows from rice fields, no laurels from crowns, no most hieroglyphics are nouns, but her fingers speak present tense, like weather and how.
Alexis Pauline Gumbs reading from her forthcoming volume, Spills, Scenes of Black Feminist Fugitivity. Also, we've been talking about Revolutionary Mothering, co-edited by Alexis Pauline Gumbs, and we were joined by one of the contributors, Norma Maroon. Norma and Alexis, thank you so much for talking with us
today. Thank you.
You can find out more about both of these works and about Alexa's forthcoming TEDx talk in Durham this weekend at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, Travis Mulhauser joins us to talk about how an image that haunted him to write actually got him to write his debut novel. Stay tuned.